Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest, and it's always a pleasure to talk to her, is writer and poet Beate Sigridottir. And we're talking about her collection of short prose pieces called Donna Nobis Possum. Beate, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Wonderful talking to you again.
It almost seemed like we were doomed. There were so many things going wrong. It was bizarre. It was a very different experience for me. I read a lot of your poetry and really, really enjoyed it. So reading your prose work, it's a completely different experience. Have you always been writing prose?
I have, actually. I tend to toggle between poetry and prose. The last year, for example, I've been mostly deliberately focusing on prose writing. And pretty soon, I think I want to write poetry again.
Is there any reason why you lost the sort of desire to write poetry? Or we could phrase that a different way. Is there a reason why you suddenly got the desire to write prose?
Well, at first, of course, my first impulse was to be a poet.
Yeah.
And then as a poet, you pretty quickly realize you're not making any money. You're not doing much with your professionally with your work unless you become poet laureate of the United States or something like that.
Now, you were poet laureate for where you are, right?
Yes. But
that's not the United States.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nobody's giving me the kinds of reading fees, you know, that the United States poet laureate received. And so I decided to write some prose, and I have tried to write all kinds of prose, including commercial. I tried to write mystery novels. But I'm not very good at writing what I'm supposed to write. So,
why am I not surprised? Because your poetry always seems to be from something that's happened to you, and it's an impulse that comes from deep inside you. I can't imagine you trying to write on assignment.
Right, and I can't. You know, there are a lot of writing groups or places where they would give you prompts to write something from. I can't do that somehow. Or they give you themes, and I should be able to do that, but somehow it's not working. So then when I did write prose, and I quite enjoyed actually telling stories, but It never became the standard storytelling. So I'm just writing what I write.
So are you inspired by certain events during the day, or is it some of these pieces which go back in time quite a way?
Right.
I try to imagine whether it was something somebody you knew, something that you that occurred to you inside your head, or what. You know, before we do any more, I want you to talk about the phrase "Donna Nobis Possum." What does it mean? Go ahead.
It's Latin, and I would pronounce it "Donna Nobis Possum."
Okay.
And it is it means "Give us peace." It's a prayer.
And it's
Latin. It's a standard Latin phrase, prayer. Give us peace.
Talk to me about why you chose that as the title.
The idea of war and peace has always been very heavy on my mind. I grew up in post-war Germany. You know, my playgrounds were ruins. Also a castle, but you know, you get used to the backlash of war, and it's been on my mind all of my life. I have never been exposed. I was born in 1951. The war was over for for 6 years, World War II we're talking about. And I've never been exposed directly to a war, but I basically grew up with war.
Yep.
And the backlash.
And I also took on another meaning for that phrase. All the protagonists in your pieces here are women. And
right.
Grant us peace can go beyond war. It's just grant us peace for women who are always being sort of the victims of different things, which are...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think all of our life concepts have to do with conflict. For example, learning how to write, taking writing courses or reading books about writing, it's always stressed that it's important to have conflict because otherwise nobody gets interested. And in a way, that's true. And in another way, that's just an incredible shame as far as I'm concerned. You know, we need to somehow find a way of making peace interesting.
Got it.
And what I'm thinking is, you know, wars do not create themselves. They come out of these strange impulses we have that, you know, we're longing for things that don't belong to us, or that are wrong for us, but at the same time, we, you know, the things that we're longing for, they glitter and they don't belong to us, but we want them, and then instantly we have internal conflict and we start external conflict, and so we have this situation where we have a lot of conflict going on.
The spiritual aspect, there's a strong spiritual aspect in many of these pieces. And sometimes it's interesting. It's you have a complex idea of God. In one of the first pieces, Good Friday, Mary Magdalene, the view of God in that is really interesting. I rage against God, but no, God rages against me. Talk to me about your spiritual feelings and how those are expressed in these stories. I know that's a personal question. You don't have to if you don't want to.
Yeah, I think that you know, reality is quite simple, and what we live in. And by the way, I believe that we're all real. I do not believe that we're all an illusion and just wandering around making a circus for some for some entity out there. I think
so. You've actually run into that theory that we're all holograms. There are people who've suggested that we're just like entertainment for some grand extraterrestrial or even extra universal source.
I haven't quite heard it that way yet, but you know it. From way past, Plato said we're just all these shadows from on the wall from some light that projects us.
Do we have free will?
Do I believe that we have free will? I think so.
Okay.
We don't know what to do with it half of the time.
You're right about that. So talk to me about your spirituality, because it is complex and it's expressed complexly in your works.
Well, I believe that we live in paradise, and that's another thing that we really don't know what to do with. You know, if I'm going out on a trail, which I do a lot. And I watch the lizards and I watch the flowers.
Don't forget the snakes. Don't forget the snakes.
Yeah. And I watch the snakes when I'm lucky enough to see one.
Thank you.
But then they all do what they're supposed to do. And we, with our somewhat compromised free will, we really keep wanting to do things other than what we are and other than what we might ought to be doing.
I got it.
And that's another area where we then get into conflict.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like this could be an absolutely amazing place if people would just stop being an idiot.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And if people would stop being, for example, bullies, you know, they would, as soon as a bully shows up, we're all in trouble, because as soon as they start acting, then we either fight, in which case we're right on their side.
Yep.
Because what we really prefer is peace, but we need to fight, or we lie down and we just keel over and say, okay, do whatever you want to do. And that's how I think we're messing up with this potential paradise that we have on our hands or under our
noses. Well, one of the things that I also found interesting is many of these pieces, if not all of them, I think it's many of them, are written in the first person.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that, because that's a difficult thing to pull off.
Actually, I think as a writer, I can immerse myself very easily into first person situation. Now, not all of these pieces in here are autobiographical, which, you know, first person might suggest, but obviously I'm not Barry Magdalene. Obviously I'm not all.
I was hoping you were, because that would have been great to put down that I got to interview you. But the effect of it is to feel like you're experiencing it, and that we're inside your head experiencing it. For instance, 1 year, which is about a woman in the aftermath of war in 1945, which is a really powerful piece. I thought that was a really, her name was Wilhelmina Weber. Is that true?
Right.
And and she's wandering. She's going through starvation. She's all sorts of privations going on. She's remembering her life. And anger trumps everything. I mean, in the aftermath of war for her. And that's a really powerful revelation. It's not something that I think a lot of people here in the United States are familiar with, of what happens when war comes and devastates your country and then you're left alive and what happens to you. And that seems to be what that piece was about. It seemed like it was a memory from you. I know you're not that old. I know you're not that old. But
it was not a direct memory from me, but earlier you said, where do I get my ideas?
Yeah.
Well, that one, the idea was, I didn't have a lot of facts, but my paternal grandmother was missing for a year. And I imagined, from knowing her, she was somewhat of an angry, anxious person, and somehow from her personality and from knowing that she was just wasn't found for a whole year by her family, I made up this story about what might have happened when she was missing. And She did come out of the war as a pretty angry person.
I can imagine.
And she did. I mean, she had lost everything, and she really didn't want to be part of this strange non-paradise world that we have created. And so that's kind of where the idea came. But any of the facts or any of the events in the story are totally made up.
But it's a very vivid account. Another one, Strange Justice, is about a woman who makes soup for someone who's in jail who had collaborated with the Germans. And it's her talking about why she bothers to do that. Again, in a lot of the pieces, the woman's anger is palpable. You know, that there's a reason why she's angry. And she can explain it and maybe express it in a lot of different ways. But it is about women rebelling against what's been set upon them.
Yeah, well, rebelling against the insanity of war in the first place, it to me, and this is very personal, but to me, war is just insane.
Yep.
I don't know if you have ever run across the movie King of Hearts.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In there, it's kind of the idea of there are these, I remember this one scene, there are these, it's a peaceful kind of village, but these two different armies meet and they face each other, and then they just have to shoot each other, you know, from both sides.
And the insane asylum ends up, and the people who inhabit it seem to behave much more sanely than the two armies.
Right.
That was a big movie when I was in college.
Yeah, and to me, the concept of war as insanity is huge, because it just doesn't make any sense.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, and is always a pleasure to talk to her, is writer and poet Beate Sigridottir. And we're talking about her collection of short stories, prose pieces, Donna Nobis Pacem, you would say? Was it Pacem? Or
Pacem.
Okay. Can I ask you to read one of these pieces?
Sure. And I'll read one that's not quite directly about war, but it is about conflict, about situations in the world. It is called The Little Mermaid, A Few Moments with the Queen. And it's based on Hans Christian Andersen's, or rather a retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's Little Mermaid. And it has a little bit of Disney mermaid in it as well. And it is in the Queen's voice. Like you said, I write a lot in first person, and obviously I'm not a queen.
Okay.
But here it is in the Queen's voice. I don't want to be ungrateful here with my grandchildren at my feet and all that. But sometimes I wish I were that mystical and insubstantial creature that dissolved from love-struck mermaid first into foam, then air. Sometimes I wish I, too, would be remembered, not for what is or was, but for what could have been, if only. Happy? Let's say I'm content, and not entirely content to be content. I'd love to have ended up happy, but that would have required my husband's commitment. And I'm not so sure he's capable of all-out commitment. The physical aspect is okay. He appreciates his Sunday roasts, his wine, his massages, his sex. He will not leave me. I'm talking human dilemma here, testosterone, estrogen, and the incompatible dreams. I've been married to the erstwhile prince for 25 years now. I know my man. I know his aches, his moods, his foibles, just as he all too frequently reminds me of mine. He always loves best what is just out of reach. Perhaps we all do. Although I have loved one fierce reality, there was a boy, not my prince, who touched the inside of my elbow once. And I was so stunned by the exquisite pleasure that I replay that touch today in memory when I need comfort in this bread and butter world. When the little mermaid, my prince's pet girl, his mute foundling, slept on his doorstep every night, then he dreamt of me. Then I was the mysterious girl from the monastery who found him on the beach. He pretended that he did not wake up until I came along, and he pretended that I rescued him. Then he pretended it was fate, ordained by God, etc. It was convenient, since it turned out that our parents wanted us to make a political alliance by marriage in the first place. Meanwhile, he had her sleep on his doorstep, telling her she was his favorite of all, to a point. Now he's getting older, but still imposing, a little slower with everything, that's all. He has his daily massages and flirts with the servants. He is convinced he is charming, using the same phrases and benevolently raised eyebrows his father used before him. Using the same phrases, in fact, that my own elderly father uses. Go figure. Thing is, my prince never really wanted to do much of anything. He didn't come courting me. He didn't come doing anything at all. There was no dragon, no difficulty whatsoever. And who does he now dream of? The one who was willful and sentimental, totally unrealistic, cost everybody a great deal, most of all herself at that. Her love for my husband cost her her own most precious voice. Isn't that often the case for a woman, human or merfolk? As for me, the older I get, the more I learn. I'm not even 50 years old yet and already a grandmother. Soon, the grandkids will ask me for fairy tales and tales of how our family came to be, tales of how we met one day by the sea. Will I tell them the dreams of happily ever after, so that they will be comforted in their gullible youth, that it will all turn out well one day, and then be bitterly disappointed later on when their prince or princess has feet not even of clay, but of mere flesh and blood? For the longest time, I couldn't grasp that it wasn't all about me, prince, crown, happy ending, marriage, and all, that my so-called happy ending was another's tragedy, and perhaps vice versa. So I lie in bed reading poems and mystery novels, and he sits on his mahogany rocking chair on the terrace, facing the sea, dreaming of her. I know she flies through the world visiting, especially children, in the shape of the spirit of the air she became. Did she visit our children? Will she now visit our grandchildren and place air kisses on their foreheads, filling their hearts with dazzling dreams of things that we have all wished for and none of us have ever been selfless enough to fulfill? The sea witch was the only one who didn't lie. Everything has its price, and oftentimes the price is beyond what anyone in their right mind should be willing to pay. Her magical voice, her sister's beautiful hair, my peace of mind. I wish he could have loved me like a fairy tale, like I, too, once thought it was promised, kissed by God only know what spirit. The way he loved me at first, when I was still out of reach, instead. As I said, I am content but not happy. That is perhaps the worst that could have happened, this achy kind of gratitude that knows that I'm stuck with what there is and it is good, but it should have been better. And I only have this one fairy tale. And even in this fairy tale, I'm bleeding over the borders. If I were a cat, maybe it would be enough to be content. But I am not a cat. My heart is not broken, just bruised. I assume at night he dreams of her and yearns for her. Maybe the air brushes his forehead and he feels kissed by her spirit self. I remind myself, as though it mattered, that when she was there, he let her sleep on his doorstep, his little mute foundling. But now that she's gone, she's ever treasured in his mind and has assumed cosmic proportions. I'm not consigned to his doorstep, thank God for that, but I'm permanently consigned to some sort of anteroom of his heart while he spent the last 25 years of reality building a mystic temple in his heart for her. He doesn't speak of it. He leaves us that much dignity. But I can tell he is in love with her. He thinks she is exquisitely important in her elegant absence. A man's love always has a price, as does a man's indifference to reality. His mute foundling lost her voice and her mermaid life as a price for love. I'm paying a price too, I'm sure, though I'm not certain what it is.
Wow.
And there you have it.
And we're just about out of time. I really got a lot out of that piece. It was great to hear you read it.
Thank you.
But it was one of those things, I sort of don't want to analyze it too much and sort of break the magic of that piece, the meaning of it. My returning guest tonight has been writer and poet Beate Seegerdaughter, and we're talking about a collection of short stories, and they're really interesting. They're really different. Dona Nobis Pacem or Pacem?
Pacem.
Pacem. Beate, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.